When I was growing up, my mom was guided by the strong belief that to befriend me was to deny me the one thing a kid really needed to survive childhood, a mother. Consequently, we were never one of those mommy and me pairs who sat close or giggled. She didn't wink at me or gush about how pretty I looked or rub my back to help me fall asleep. She was not a big fan of deep conversation, and she still doesn't go for a lot of physical contact. She looked at motherhood less as a joy to be relished than as a job to be done, serious work with serious repercussions. And I left childhood assuming our way of being with each other, adversarial but functional, was as it would be. If my mother thought of me as someone to guide, my father thought of me as someone to cheer. I was his girl, as in, "That's my girl. Have you met my girl?" He liked to hold hands and high-five and was almost impossible to frustrate or disappoint. His signature, "you bet, why not," energy was all I needed for several decades. But then my life became more consequential, and I woke up needing things he could not supply. A certain understanding, call it a seasoning, that only my mother seemed to have. Her areas of expertise, which had often appeared piddling or immaterial, became disturbingly relevant. And that's saying nothing about the second-guessing and anxieties I could take to her, worries that would only ever bounce off my dad's optimism, as was the case on the day I was told I needed surgery. I remember leaving the doctor thinking three things. I can't have more kids. It's for my own good. I need my mom. On the way to the parking lot, I dialed home, or I should say the place that was home when I was a child. My dad ran to pick up the phone on the first ring. I know because I've seen him do it 100 times. He loves connecting. He's dying to catch up. He can't wait to hear your voice, anyone's voice. "Lovey," he sang out, as if it had been years, not days, since we talked. "How's my girl?" "I'm okay. Is Mom there?" I wasn't crying, but I wanted to. "What?" he said in mock hysteria. "You don't want to talk to Greenie, the green man?" My dad's brothers have been calling him Greenie since college. I'd always thought it referred to the Irish in him, but it turns out it's more about a bad hangover. "You're breaking my heart, lovey." "Sorry, I just need Mom." "She's at the bridge table, probably making her opponents weep right this minute." I asked him to have her call me when she got back and told him I couldn't talk right now. That was A-okay with him because everything is A-okay with him. "Love you, mean it," he signed off as usual. "Love you, mean it." Before I got in my car, I called my mom's cell and left a message explaining that Dr. Rawson would be taking out my ovaries a week from Thursday. I tried to sound cool and relaxed about it. I said I was being spayed, ha ha. I hoped she would hear past my witty BS. 2 years before, a lump I found in my breast turned out to be a 7-centimeter tumor. So I did what people with tumors do: chemotherapy, radiation, surgery. I also started taking a tiny pill every day to suppress ovarian function, since my cancer used estrogen to multiply. After 90 days, my periods kept coming. I bragged to the doc that I was born to breed. Turned out there was something on my ovary, a cyst most likely, but it did not wax and wane the way cysts should. It sat there, stubborn, ominous. The time had come. "You have kids?" the doctor asked. "Yeah, 2 girls, 3 and 5. We do this now, maybe we avoid something worse later." Crossing the Bay Bridge, San Francisco disappearing behind me, I did not call my husband. Edward was a reasonable man who took zinc at the first sign of a cold, stretched thoroughly before and after exercise, and when lifting heavy objects, used his legs, not his back. He was, in all situations, an advocate for avoiding something worse. I did not call either of my older brothers, I do not have a sister, and I was not quite ready to involve a girlfriend. So I called my mom's cell again, and this time she answered. She said she just hung up with the idiot at the airlines, who wouldn't accept her frequent flyer miles, which were barely expired. And I said, God help the customer service guy who took that call. But what I thought was, she's coming. She arrived from Philly the day before I went in for surgery, letting Edward carry her tiny black suitcase on wheels up the stairs, where she would unpack all her must-haves. a silk pillowcase that keeps her hairdo looking nice, her mauve bathrobe with giant pearly buttons, a small jelly jar of Smirnoff because she doesn't like the expensive vodka we buy, and several strange secondhand presents. A bedazzled purse, one of my old Nancy Drews, a down vest with a broken zipper, for the girls. Georgia and Claire love her, and always have. She's different with them. She makes Jell-O, 100% sugar-free, Kelly, and plays crazy eights and rubs lotion on their clean feet and reads them whatever they bring to her, even the long books with no pictures. When she leaves them, she cries, actually cries, with real tears. From a woman who extended the adage, children should be seen and not heard, with, and preferably, not seen, it's startling, like opening your toolbox and discovering that your supposedly industrial-strength staples are made of Play-Doh.